Okay, sliding into the seat here. How are you? This is WEFT Champaign Urbana, your friendly listener-sponsored radio station. My name is Paul Muth. I'm in with the show News from Neptune. I call it the radio edit, though I do get podcasts. I get Pacifica stuff from around the nation. Go to the UK for TaxCast, and there's a good one this week, but there's so much stuff going on. Generally, I do a show called Window on the World, which is more international issues, but as I like to say, because the fact that the U.S. is a hyperpower, national issues are international issues, and it's all mixed up. So, I also have a web exclusive from Amy Goodman, was paired with a longer interview she did with a dissenting Israeli, talking about the soldiers who are threatening to withhold their service, which is a big thing in the Sparta nation, where everyone serves in the military. What else do I have? Amy Goodman's got something about the pardon power again. She had one on Leonard Peltier and calling for people to call the president and ask him to pardon Peltier, commute his sentence, get him back to the reservation with his friends and family. Oh, it's Noam Chomsky's birthday, that's right. Also, Pearl Harbor Day. You know, they knew in advance, they just didn't expect it to be as dramatic, and that's something that can be extrapolated to 9/11, October 7th, in my opinion. Opinions are those of the speakers. So, Hagal is the guy's name, I guess, who we'll hear from right after Amy Goodman's commentary. And then her understudy, Jeremy Scahill, has a deconstructed episode. They've split off into Drop Zone. They've had an amicable separation and are still doing shows with The Intercept. And they're both on the model that we use, too, listener-supported. So if you can support, maybe I should announce it here too. I'm hesitant about doing a Facebook fundraising campaign, but my birthday's tomorrow, so I thought I would later today put up a call for supporting community media, both WEFT and IMC, your choice. So you can always do that, but if you want to do it in Noam Chomsky's memory, he's not gone yet, but he's certainly shut down lots of functions, but his work lives on. Has a book on Cuba, but as his last, I guess, co-authored with Vijay Prashad, who I haven't heard from in a while. So the Scahill piece is about Syria. Things are changing quite rapidly, so I don't know whether I can play the discussion he had. I have a segment of that seems to be okay. It's sort of a background about the whole Byzantine nature of the arrangement. I guess that's not quite the right area. What is the name of that so-called sycamore or something? Timber Sycamore, that was the name of the CIA's funding of the rebels against the Assad regime, both repugnant, it seems to me, but the U.S. picks a side, and it actually seems to pick the more repugnant side. This is blowback. This is a policy. This is using miscreants, often the most extreme militants, that was done in Afghan, called the Afghan Trap by some. Anyway, I'm eating up into the time of the presenters. I think I have enough. And then I do have a home-based issue. There is a podcast called Nuclear Hot Seat, which I haven't sampled much of it yet, but an interesting woman who went to school here is now doing this podcast called Nuclear Hot Seat. It's about nuclear power and nuclear weapons. And there was recently a conference Outrider Nuclear Reporting Summit. A very prestigious group supporting, of course, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. Bulletin of Nuclear Scientists? I forget now. I guess it's Atomic Scientists. They're the ones that set the doomsday clock, and it's closer to midnight than it's ever been. Caught her flying back to L.A. to get permission to edit her segment a bit. And that's because she has done a recent interview with an author, Ramanan, who has a book out, and I have it in the other room, not in front of me, called Nuclear is Not the Answer, something to that effect. I'll have more information. That'll be the last segment of the show. So let's kick it with Amy Goodman's commentary again about the power of the lame duck. Mumi Abu-Jamal didn't have a recent commentary, but he does come up in that he should be commuted. His sentence should be commuted too. A fairness and accuracy in reporting, who we just heard from in the Counterspin show, have a short segment available on their fair.org website that goes into the Mumia trial, catalogs some of the flagrant things, racist judge, no gunshot residue tests of Mumia's hands, see whether he was the shooter or not. Details like that are in the brief. So if you wanted to comment to the president and say that there's evidence that it was a mistrial, miscarriage of justice at least, maybe you want to do that. Go away, Windows. Yeah. Speaking of Amazon, a lot of people are disturbed with Bezos because of the Washington Post. Why don't these people quit Amazon too? Maybe have one of their neighbors or friends keep a subscription so they can watch that cultural product that's so important to them. I don't think that's a violation of their, you know, have friends over to watch something and take some money away from Amazon. Amazon, who was losing money on their main, known for is distributing goods while making money on their data centers. And one of their major contracts was the CIA. I always thought, you know, while they're tearing down bricks and mortar by undercutting the prices and losing money on it, they're getting subsidized for their computers and their cloud services by the Alphabet, the company. That's too much of a preamble, but let's kick it, and I'll try to put a sock in it. And Amy Goodman's kicking it off, breaking the sound barrier.
Biden's pardon power and the last federal pot prisoners. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Today, I signed a pardon for my son, Hunter, President Joe Biden said in a statement released by the White House on December 1st, quote, I hope Americans will understand why a father and a president would come to this decision, unquote. Hunter Biden awaited sentencing for two federal criminal convictions, for lying about his drug addiction on a gun purchase form and for tax evasion. He most likely would have spent less than 5 years behind bars. Joe Biden correctly labeled the prosecutions as partisan and politically motivated. Quote, Hunter was singled out only because he is my son, Biden said. With the simple stroke of a pen, President Biden saved his son from a terrible ordeal. Before he leaves office, he should extend the same compassion to thousands of people in federal prison, victims of the so-called war on drugs.
This is definitely an opening for folks to talk about exactly how expansive we can use the pardon power of the president to make sure that we're correcting the injustices that were done over the past 20 or 30 years when it comes to cannabis crimes.
Jason Ortiz, director of strategic initiatives at the Last Prisoner Project, said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
President Biden himself was actually one of the architects of the 1994 crime bill that created a lot of the outrageous sentences that we're now dealing with today.
Ortiz was referring to the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994, which Biden championed as a senator and which accelerated mass incarceration. Udi Ofer, former director of the ACLU's Justice Division, wrote in 2019 on the crime bill's 25th anniversary, quote, "Under the leadership of Bill Clinton, Democrats wanted to wrest control of crime issues from Republicans, so the two parties began a bidding war to increase penalties for crime, trying to outdo one another," unquote. Democrats have largely accepted the failure of the 1994 crime bill. In 2015, former President Bill Clinton admitted,
"The problem is the way it was written and implemented is we cast too wide a net. We have too many people in prison."
While campaigning for president in 2019 and 2020, though, Joe Biden repeatedly denied that the law he helped write contributed to mass incarceration. Jason Ortiz continued.
"There are over 3,000 federal cannabis prisoners currently incarcerated on cannabis charges. And these are all folks that also have families and have parents and have loved ones. And we have examples like folks like Jonathan Wall, who is somebody that was a Maryland resident. He was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison for his first offense. And so while I can understand why the president wants to have compassion for his own son, where we're really getting frustrated is that he's refusing to extend that compassion to all the parents that are currently watching their kids waste away in prison."
On October 6, 2022, President Biden issued a blanket pardon for those convicted federally for simple marijuana possession. The Justice Department explained then, however, that, quote, "conspiracy, distribution, and possession with intent to distribute are not pardoned by the proclamation," unquote. The goal of the Last Prisoner Project is to expand the relief from the drug war's draconian sentences to those convicted of distribution and other charges.
"Right now, we have folks that are serving decades for trafficking, which is exactly what the hundreds of legal cannabis businesses across the country are currently doing on a regular basis, including right in Washington, D.C. And so we're now seeing people sitting in prison for decades for the same activity that is currently generating tax revenue for cities and states across the country. We're paying for schools and building bridges with cannabis activity dollars, but still letting folks waste away in prison."
The Last Prisoner Project is not alone in calling for clemency. Last month, as President Biden prepared to pardon turkeys as part of an annual Thanksgiving photo op, more than 50 members of Congress sent a letter urging Biden to use the pardon power to address the ongoing crisis of mass incarceration.
"The United States represents just 5% of the world's population, yet we hold more than 20% of the global prison population."
Progressive Minnesota Congressmember Ilhan Omar said at a news conference announcing the letter,
"Over 1.9 million individuals are currently incarcerated, with a disproportionate impact on communities of color. Black men are incarcerated at more than five times the rate of white men, a legacy of systematic inequalities that have persisted for generations. President Biden has a real opportunity to make a difference. In these final days of his term, we are calling on him to act."
Hunter Biden will very likely never see the inside of a prison cell, nor experience the discrimination and indignities imposed on former felons. President Biden has the power to pardon thousands of people imprisoned for federal cannabis crimes or commute their sentences to time served and allow them to return home. The power is in his hands, but he still needs to be pushed by the millions of citizens in whose name he wields it. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan. This is Democracy Now!
I guess that's a little foreshadowing, the vagaries of this computer I'm using. Going to go on with that web exclusive. This is the 972 magazine journalist, Hage Matar. That's a journal in Israel, though it's widely read now. I haven't been there in a bit. His main interview, Acts of Massacre and Ethnic Cleansing, Hage Matar on Gaza War, ICC Arrests, and More, was followed by this unaired piece on conscientious objectors in Israel, Netanyahu's crackdown on the press. So we're going to hear that segment that hasn't been aired. I'm looking for the audio of the general, former defense minister under Netanyahu a while back, who had this amazing talk where he used the word genocide and ethnic cleansing. I posted it on Facebook, and Facebook's playback didn't have the subtitles, so you have this screed in Hebrew. I'm going to repost it from and use the YouTube version, which maybe that's Google-generated. Looking for some audio version of it so I could play it, because reading the subtitles is amazing, but to hear it spoken would be even more so. Dissent is stirring in Israel, and we're hearing about it here from 972 journalist right now.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our conversation with Haggai Mattar, Israeli journalist, activist, executive director of 972 magazine, former conscientious objector who refused to serve in the Israeli army, you just wrote a piece in The Nation magazine that's the gist of the headline is, are we doing enough to deal with what's happening right now in Gaza? There was a piece that Oren Ziv wrote in 972, your publication, just out, we must use every tool to resist Israeli teens jailed for refusing military service. You're a conscientious objector yourself. Talk about your own decision, when you made it, and the state of the movement of conscientious objectors today in Israel.
Sure. So I refused a very, very long time ago, actually together with my colleague Oren Ziv in 2002. I had spent 2 years in prison back then for refusing the draft. That is quite unusual. Most teens that refuse the draft would go to prison for about 3 to 4 months. That is what is likely expected with the recent refusers.
How old are you?
At the time, I was 18.
Why 2 years?
Well, we're talking about the height of the second intifada. There was a spike in refusal. Usually, unfortunately, we only have 1 to, say, 4 kids at a time that refuse and go to prison. When I refused, there were times that we were 40 in military prison. We were packing military prison, both young people refusing the draft and reservists who were saying we won't go back to oppressing Palestinians in the occupied territories. So the movement was really growing, and singling out a couple of us to put us on court martial and sentence for a very, very long prison sentence was basically a way to break the movement.
And so talk about the movement today.
So today there is a very, very impressive new generation of kids that have seen the horrors of the Gaza war and are saying that they will not take part in any of it. Actually, these kids have been saying, you know, the horrors of October 7th and the horrors of the Gaza war are both things that should never happen again, and we must stop them. And the way to do that is by refusing. They were sentenced this week, both of them, for the first round of imprisonment. They have several friends that are already in prison and have been going back and forth in and out of prison for a cumulative couple of months. So the movement is still there. It's still fighting. We're still talking about a few individuals at any given time. But I think it's important and inspirational for so many people. We know it's meaningful for other teenagers considering the draft. It's meaningful for Palestinians that hear about people going to prison so as not to participate in oppression. And I think it's a message for the world.
Talk more about these two teens, Ido Lam and Asol Behar Salik.
Mm-hmm. Well, the two of them have, Ido comes from a family of left-wing activists. His father is an immigration lawyer, and he's been very much involved in Banki, which is kind of the youth movement of the Communist Party in Israel. And his partner is, actually, I don't know him as well, but Ido is someone I've seen kind of grow through the years into realizing that going into the army is just not a possibility for him.
So you started Plus 972. In when? 2009?
There were some founders of 972 that started in 2010 to 11. I joined late 2011 and became staff, you know, person 2014.
And explain for a global audience what Plus 972 is and why it's even called that.
So Plus 972 is the international prefix if you want to dial in to Israel or Palestine. Whenever you want to call, you would dial that. And basically, this is our way of telling the world what is happening in Israel-Palestine. The magazine has evolved over the years, and today it is a binational, independent, nonprofit outlet run by Palestinian and Israeli journalists. We also, the team behind it also co-publishes together with Just Vision, a site called Local Call, which is in Hebrew. And in both these initiatives, we try to bring out information about the realities of oppression, of apartheid, of war crimes, publish investigations, analysis, offering an alternative and a better future for all residents of our region.
So I want to also talk about another news outlet. Last month, the Israeli cabinet unanimously voted to sanction Haaretz, the newspaper, saying its editorials have hurt the legitimacy of the state of Israel and its right to self-defense, unquote. Under the move, the government will stop advertising in Haaretz and cut off communications with it. Haaretz slammed the decision, saying it's, quote, another step in Netanyahu's journey to dismantle Israeli democracy. Like his friends Putin, Erdogan, and Orban, Netanyahu is trying to silence a critical independent newspaper. Haaretz will not balk and will not morph into a government pamphlet that publishes messages approved by the government and its leader, unquote. This all comes 6 months after Israel banned Al Jazeera from operating in Israel. So if you can talk about the overall crackdown and what this means, Haaretz is what, like 100 years old?
Yeah, older. Yes, I think, first of all, a lot of solidarity with our colleagues in Haaretz. They're the only mainstream media outlet that is speaking anything about what's happening in Gaza. Seriously, they have some great people there doing that work. And this attack, we need to understand it in the context of an increasing attack on media freedoms. And like anything else in Israel-Palestine, there's deep differentiation between the treatment of Palestinian journalists, of whom over 160 have been killed by Israel the past year in Gaza. So, you know, we need to remember that whenever we talk about press freedoms. Haaretz is facing an ad ban. And Palestinian journalists are just being killed by the dozen. So just got to remember that. But the journalists in Haaretz are facing what is part of an ongoing attack on press freedoms in Israel. This bill that outlawed Al Jazeera is targeting foreign outlets that represent so-called a threat to national security. The initiators of that bill are talking about expanding that bill to outlaw Israeli outlets that so-called threat to national security. So outlets like ours, like Haaretz, could be up next, basically. And this is just one part of a set of attacks on the free media in Israel. It's very, very dangerous. And while I have a lot of criticism of my colleagues in the mainstream that have just betrayed our profession by not talking about Gaza, I'm also deeply concerned with the way that the government is trying to take over all of the media and make sure that, you know, it's 100% committed to the line of supporting Netanyahu.
Can you talk, Hagai Mator, about military censorship? How does it work?
So in Israel, all stories that have anything to do with military or security issues, and there's a very long list of what is concerning national security, have to be submitted in advance to the military censor. There are military censors sitting in studios, TV studios, radio studios, and reviewing material that is about to be published with a short delay. Stories that we write have to be published with the censor, and they have the right to stop publication, to redact parts, and you're not allowed to say what was removed or how. That is absolutely appalling. It's the only country in the world that describes itself as democratic and has such a terrible institution. Still, I do want to say the most important stories do get out. The censorship doesn't stop, usually doesn't serve the political interests of the leadership, very rarely does. But usually the biggest stories, like stories we have published on AI and the way that the army uses AI to generate kill lists and kill over 1,000 Palestinian families with AI machines, that's a huge story we were able to break, and the censorship didn't stop us from that. So while there is a censorship, most of the censorship...
You're talking about the stories of Yuval Abraham,
yes.
Where's Daddy, and also Lavender.
Yeah, exactly.
And so explain, what does the military do?
So we have to file those stories with the censor, and I'm not at liberty to say how they intervene. They're not allowed to add things, but they can take out parts, and we can't discuss them. However, it's really important to say the vast majority of our findings we were able to publish. And when the Israeli media does not share our findings, when they don't go into Gaza and do their own reporting, when they don't rely on the reporting of Palestinian journalists and tell Israelis what is happening, it is not because of the censorship. It is because of their own self-censorship.
And before we end, you spent 2 years in jail. Young people now who are resisting are spending a couple months in jail. Are you all in the same jails as Palestinian prisoners?
No, not all. Conscientious objectors go to a military prison, and I myself was transferred from a military prison at some point to a civilian prison. But even there, there's complete segregation between Palestinian political prisoners and criminal prisoners. There are Israeli citizens, so it's completely separated.
Mm. Well, I want to thank you for being with us. Hagai Mator, Israeli journalist, activist, executive director of Plus972 magazine, former conscientious objector who refused to serve in the Israeli army, was in prison for 2 years in Israel. To see part one of our discussion, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
And that brought up a lot of issues. I've been playing Chris Hedges on the case of Gray Zone reporter Lafredo, a U.S. journalist who was put in solitary confinement for about 3 days and pretty much manhandled and harassed for his reporting. getting around the military censor. And I'm trying to search for, see whether Amy had a headline on that or not, but weird things happen. Sorry to bring about what I was talking about. Well, as I mentioned, the second part of the hour, getting to nuclear is not the solution, the folly of atomic power in the age of climate change by M.V. Ramanan. I found this podcast called Nuclear Hot Seat. Talked to the producer and got permission to edit it a bit to get it on. And I'm still working to get it on. I guess I'll be excerpting the Deconstructed with Jeremy Scahill, which is what I said I'd be doing next. I won't get to as much of the discussion. I'll be going over that. And I'll be going to the gray zone to see what they're saying about the Syria situation. But, yeah. Timber Sycamore. TS? I don't know. That's the acronym for the last decade's arming of the Syrian rebels that blowback continues to this day, in my opinion. I thought this was a brilliant summary of the situation by Scahill. So let's check this out and then get to the local issue. It is a local issue because, well, the producer went to school here. That's not a real issue, but this is a hotbed of nuclear academic work. And there's talk of one of these cute little modular reactors being over at the Abbott Power Plant, where they are burning coal, by the way, gas and coal dust at the same time, apparently. Yeah, you want to have a mini nuke down on Oak Street? That's hits us where we live, I guess. Here's Jeremy Scahill from Deconstructed, though he's with Hot Drop Zone. They have an amicable relationship, apparently.
DJ Spooky.
This is Intercepted. Scahill coming to you from Dropsite News, dropsitenews.com. At this moment, Joe Biden has just weeks left in his presidency before Donald Trump takes over as president. Israel's genocidal war against Gaza is continuing at full force. The so-called ceasefire in Lebanon was by design meant to only require Hezbollah to cease its fire. And the UN has, as of Tuesday, documented more than 100 violations of the ceasefire by Israel, including gradually intensifying its military strikes in southern Lebanon. After several days of Israeli attacks, Hezbollah fired back what it said was a warning to Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu is now saying he's going to escalate even further. It is an incendiary situation that was entirely predictable to anyone who studied how the U.S. structured this agreement. It actually gave Israel a secret side letter to the agreement that effectively said that Israel can continue to launch attacks inside Lebanon. This is a pattern that we've seen play out repeatedly, where the U.S. and Israel claim that every attack Israel launches, whether in Gaza or in Lebanon, is self-defense, and any attack launched by Israel's adversaries constitute grave violations. In the midst of all of this, last week, armed opposition forces seeking to topple the government of Bashar al-Assad in Syria stunned the region when they marched into Syria's second-largest city of Aleppo and encountered almost no resistance from the Syrian armed forces or their allies. That operation was led by the group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or the Organization for the Liberation of the Levant. HTS, as it's commonly called, and its leader, have their origins in ISIS and al-Qaeda, though the group's leader, Abu Muhammad al-Jalani, has spent the past several years trying to rebrand his forces as a sort of national liberation front that is no longer affiliated with either al-Qaeda or ISIS. On today's show, we're going to take a deep dive look into that group and into al-Jalani's history. While the events in Syria unfold against the backdrop of the U.S.-facilitated Israeli wars in Gaza and Lebanon, there are many factors that led to this moment in Syria. It is true that Syria is formally part of the Axis of Resistance, a coalition of state and non-state actors in the region who have pledged to join forces in confronting Israel. This axis also includes Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq, the Houthis in Yemen. Syria has been an important strategic route for the supply of weapons into Lebanon, and for years, Hezbollah forces have been some of the most effective guerrilla troops fighting on the side of the Syrian government against its armed opponents, including HTS. Israel also recently threatened direct military action against the Syrian government if it helps facilitate weapons to Hezbollah or assists it in rebuilding its forces. Netanyahu said Assad is, quote, playing with fire if he enables Iranian shipments to pass through Syria. Israel made those threats just before the opposition forces began their drive into Aleppo last week. At the same time, it is an ahistorical oversimplification to attempt to force the events of the past week in Syria exclusively into the context of the Gaza and Lebanon wars. Since 2011 and the Assad government's brutal attacks against protesters who rose up during the Arab Spring uprisings, there has been a civil war in Syria, and a horrifying number of Syrian civilians have been killed and forcibly displaced. There are a tremendous number of outside nations and armed groups involved. Russia, Iran, the United States, multiple Gulf nations, Turkey, they all have their hands in Syria. Hundreds of thousands of Syrians have been killed. Some 12 million Syrians, roughly half the country's population, have been forcibly displaced, and more than 5 million of them have taken refuge outside of Syria. In addition to its covert and overt support to armed opposition factions inside Syria, the U.S. government has also sought to weaken the Assad government by using crippling sanctions and leading a campaign to isolate Syria globally. At various points, the CIA and the U.S. military have been deeply involved in the Syria war as part of a loose coalition of armed factions, some of which have historical ties to Al-Qaeda or ISIS, a fact that U.S. officials have actually publicly acknowledged. In fact, by 2015, the CIA's support for so-called rebel groups in Syria constituted one of the largest covert operations in the agency's history, roughly $1 billion a year to train armed opposition forces. At the same time, Washington has not yet unleashed the full spectrum of attacks and covert operations that could fully bring down Assad or his government. And there's debate within the U.S. national security apparatus about the consequences of regime change in Syria. The Syrian factions fighting against Assad, including those backed by the U.S., have committed widespread human rights abuses and engaged in indiscriminate attacks against civilians. They've also been widely documented to have targeted ethnic and religious minorities, and they use torture and extrajudicial detention. One point that must be said: no one should view the U.S. role in Syria as being motivated by humanitarian concerns or the love of democracy. That's just not how the U.S. operates. It has been the premier destabilizing force in the Middle East for decades, and it has shown a willingness to get into bed with all manner of nefarious characters or groups if it believes it serves U.S. interests. And it has been responsible for a range of regime change operations that have caused massive bloodshed, chaos, and destruction. History has repeatedly shown that for the U.S., yesterday's allies often become tomorrow's enemies. Now, just because the U.S. is involved doesn't mean that every opposition force in Syria is somehow a tool of the CIA. And I think people need to be very careful about stripping away the agency of Syrians who actually oppose the government of their country. We must be careful not to use a broad brush and to recognize that the victims of this war are Syrians themselves, and it is they that should have the lead voice in what happens in their country. On the other end of the great powers equation, Russia has consistently intervened to defend the government in Damascus, and Russian forces have carried out some of the most deadly attacks of the more than decade-long war. While Syria has portrayed its military campaign against areas controlled by anti-government forces as a sort of war against terrorism, the overwhelming majority of people killed in Russian and Syrian attacks have been Syrian civilians. Assad's government regularly uses torture against its opponents. Russia also should not be viewed as acting in any sort of humanitarian interest. For Moscow, Syria is a crucial zone in the global chessboard, and it is acting in its own interests. Both Hezbollah and Iran have deployed forces inside of Syria to aid the Assad government, and Hezbollah forces have played a decisive role in defeating armed opponents of the Syrian government, allowing Damascus to reclaim lost territory, including in the areas of Syria now being seized by HTS. Throughout the past year, Israel has repeatedly bombed inside of Syria, though it has portrayed the strikes as mostly targeting Iranian and Hezbollah forces or areas of operation and not Assad's forces directly. While Israel has staked out a generally hostile public stance toward the Syrian government, it has also suggested numerous times that it would rather Assad remain in power than have Syria come under the control of an Islamist government. Prior to the 2011 uprisings in Syria and the outbreak of the civil war, Israel and Syria were actually engaged in indirect talks about a potential peace agreement of sorts. Israel hoped to weaken the relationship between Tehran and Damascus, but that era has passed. What has happened since is that the alliance became stronger as Assad needed help from both Iran and Russia to maintain his hold on power and to fight off the multi-front armed insurrections against his government. There is a lot to discuss, but we won't be able to cover every single aspect of the situation in Syria or the history behind it, but we will try to get into as much as possible. I think it's important right now to examine the forces that are at the center of this unfolding situation in Syria, particularly HTS and its leadership. To do so, I'm joined now by Dr. Ayman Jawad Al-Tamimi. He's a historian and translator who focuses on Iraq, Syria, and jihadism, and he's one of the leading scholars on the history of ISIS, the Islamic State, and has written extensively on the various factions fighting in Syria's civil war. Dr. Al-Tamimi, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
So I want to begin just with the most basic sort of TikTok of what we saw happened and who was behind it when armed opposition forces in Syria took Aleppo.
Yes, yeah, so what happened was over the course of last week, the insurgent factions based in the region of Idlib and its environs in northwest Syria, principally led by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which we will get to, launched this operation called Deterring the Aggression, which was aimed at the Syrian government forces and its allies along a front ranging from western Aleppo countryside through to Idlib countryside. So basically the same northwest front that had been frozen since 2020 by a Turkish-Russian ceasefire that was agreed for the region. And nominally, the idea of this offensive was to deter the increasing number of aerial attacks, particularly in the form of suicide drones that were being launched by Syrian government's allies towards insurgent-held positions within Idlib and its surrounding. And they made a very rapid advance and broke through the lines in the western Aleppo countryside, moving towards Aleppo. And as the week went on, it wasn't even sure, were they actually going to push right into Aleppo city? And sure enough, this is what actually happened. They pushed into Aleppo city. And in terms of actually taking the city itself, they pretty much did it without a fight. So what happened initially is when the insurgents broke through the lines, it's true the government and its allies did bring up reinforcements towards the west of Aleppo city. But these weren't enough actually to stop the advance. And then by the time it came to actually moving into Aleppo city and then moving in neighborhood after neighborhood, this was largely just wandering in. That was a surprise even to residents of the city.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because it seemed as though it was just like the Assad government forces just sort of melted like butter. And this, you know, for anyone who has followed, even in a kind of peripheral way, the civil war in Syria, this was a stunning development that they were able to so swiftly move into the center of Aleppo, no?
I know, that's definitely right. I mean, I think if you'd asked most observers, Syrian observers, would you have expected this? The answer would definitely have been no. So it was doubtful they could move in or even hold it. But once the first defensive line just west of Aleppo City collapsed, and once I heard actually from someone who was in Aleppo City but then fled to Damascus, it was clear there was just this expected outcome that Aleppo, the entire city, was going to fall. And sure enough, that's what happened. And as I mentioned, it was largely without a fight. I think if you were wondering why this happened, I think it speaks... there are two analogies I actually think of internationally. One is for comparison, in contrasting comparison. One is the Ukraine offensive in 2023, which largely did not break through Russian lines and barely took any territory and came with very heavy casualties. And of course, why was that? Because the Russians had entrenched their defenses and were very well prepared for any foreign offensive that was going to come. And then the other scenario to look at is when Hamas broke through Gaza on October 7th. In this case, the failing is a bit like what happened with Gaza on October 7th in terms of security failing, in the a lack of anticipation and preparation for such a scenario. I think what has happened on the Syrian government side is with the freezing of the front lines, there was basically this expectation that it would just continue indefinitely like that, and that what the basic approach seemed to be is that the Syrian government would maintain its position that for any normalization with Turkey, Turkey would have to withdraw its troops from the northwest region where they were helping to maintain this ceasefire arrangement. And they didn't really anticipate or prepare for the possibility the insurgents might try to launch a major offensive. Now, if you look at what Hayat Tahrir al-Sham was saying, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham's leadership was saying, in particular Abu Muhammad al-Jolani, he did talk multiple times over the years about the idea that the military fight wasn't over, we would continue, we would hope to take Aleppo, hope to take Damascus eventually. And to be honest, I mean, a lot of observers, if you've asked them, probably myself included, would have said, well, this is rhetoric to maintain credibility. And not really giving credence to the possibility that it would actually happen, because the tendency was to view the international understandings between Russia and Turkey as helping to maintain an indefinite ceasefire. If you look also at policy recommendations about the region, it was all generally along the lines of the mainstream consensus was it's just better to maintain the ceasefire arrangement indefinitely, and that hopefully it could be maintained. So not really giving possibility that an insurgent actor, an armed group actor, would try to shake up the status quo. And that's actually where, again, I think the Hamas analogy comes in. I think what Hamas was trying to do on October 7th is, it's a bit like this. It's shake up the status quo. And there was this more immediate pretext of deterring the increasing drone attacks. But I think more broadly, there was this idea of trying to shake up the status quo. And so that's actually the best explanation I can think of for why you had this such rapid collapse. Secondarily, I would talk also about there are, I think, some issues in the on the Syrian government forces side about issues of command and control and growing problems or continued problem of desertion and corruption and evading military service and evading the draft or deserting the army. One of the reasons for that is that when you've had such a sharp deterioration in the value of the Syrian pound, in part due to US sanctions and Western sanctions on Syria, it has the value of the currency is decreased so low that the salary for conscripts is it's just continuously decreased over time, and there's just an incentive not to be on military service at all because the terms of service are so harsh. I mean, interestingly, on that West Aleppo, one of the bigger trends that's happened over the years in terms of on the Syrian government side is that people who are working with, say, Iranian-backed groups or Hezbollah-backed groups, they were transferred over into the Syrian army's regular divisions, you know, to maintain consistency about laws of military service. But that meant much harsher conditions of service, and therefore actually just gave people who were transferred over an incentive not to serve on the front lines. There were, of course, Iranian-backed and Hezbollah-backed personnel, Syrian fighters, on those same front lines. But that also, that raises a command and control issue. There wasn't, I think, this unified single command and authority to coordinate between, to coordinate and actually mount an effective resistance on these front lines.
It's all a bunch of military strategy that I'm not sure reflects the reality, but I'll offer it anyway. And I may get to more of it tomorrow. That was from Deconstructed, Project of the Intercept, but Opzone still maintains a relationship, so that's Jeremy Scahill with his guest. Some of it's been superseded by events since further incursions have happened. Okay, moving on to what I suggested I was going to do and forgetting that I had some business to do. The labor people are taking the, well, they're not taking the day off. They're actually working somewhere. Two of them are. Well, anyway. So there'll be a repeat of the previous labor hour. Stephanie was gone for the whole month of teaching, and Gus had to do some teaching this evening as well, or this afternoon as well. Speaking of the IMC, I think there's a general meeting tonight. Check your local listings. I'm forgetting things. Things are coming so fast. I also forgot to do any kind of underwriting announcement at the top of the hour. It's been hard to retrain myself, so we might be excerpting the nuclear hot seat excerpt that I already excerpted with Libby Halevy. She graduated from here, actually, now living in L.A., but I mentioned she had been on the East Coast at a conference about reporting on nuclear issues, both nuclear weapons and nuclear power. A very intriguing conference indeed. I'm sure she'll be generating a lot of material from that. It was the Outrider Nuclear Reporting Summit happened with lots of academic and other input. Some great titles. All right, here's a short underwriting announcement. Got to do a little business, and then part of the interview she conducted with Nuclear is Not the Solution author M.V. Ramana, The Folly of Atomic Power in the Age of Climate Change. Here in the belly of the nuclear industry, in a way, the U of I campus, and where a mini reactor was suggested for the Abbott power plant site a while back. I think that got shot out of the water pretty quick, but they might put it over on the west end of town.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT and That's the Cut Barbershop. Located in Mahomet, That's the Cut is a retro barbershop offering professional haircuts and shaves. That's the Cut Barbershop, 601 East Main Street in Mahomet, 217-855-9673, and on Facebook or the Booksy app. That's the Cut Barbershop.
Okay, let's go right to Libby Halevy from Nuclear Hot Seat podcast, available, but it's also broadcast on a number of stations. Again, she's a U of I alum. How about that happenstance?
Nuclear and climate change. No, it's not the solution. Nuclear is a bigger part of the problem and siphons off monies that should be going to genuine renewables like solar, wind, water, and geothermal. But that fact is ignored in the deluge of techniques used by the nuclear industry to justify and promote its toxic products. What to do? It takes a genuine expert on not only the science, but the political, social, and media issues surrounding this dangerous technology. So when he tells us,
the term small modular reactors it is meant to also evoke the idea of it being physically small, you know, cute things that you can put in your neighborhood. But in reality, a small reactor, the small part of that, only refers to the power output.
So small modular nuclear reactors are not cute little Lego-like mini power plants, but rather low power generating weak reactors that come with all the same problems as their larger siblings: cost overruns, production delays, and creation of highly radioactive waste. There's been a growing push for what the industry refers to as SMRs, small modular reactors, which very neatly takes out the word nuclear. So I refer to them as SMNRs, or small modular nuclear reactors. And governments around the world are jumping on that bandwagon, throwing ever greater amounts of money at companies that claim to be able to make these modular, cute, I call them like Legos, that get stuck together nuclear reactors. And there's a lot that's wrong with them. First, what is the difference between the older generation of nuclear reactors, the large ones that we have that are in operation, and these proposed new ones?
The term small modular reactors, it is meant to also evoke the idea of it being physically small, you know, cute things that you can put in your neighborhood. But in reality, a small reactor, the small part of that, only refers to the power output. A small modular nuclear reactor is defined as one whose power output is less than 300 megawatts. That's the International Atomic Energy Agency's definition. So the 300 megawatts is roughly about a third of the size of the typical reactor we construct today. You usually say it's about 1,000 megawatts. The reactors that were built in Vogel are designed to generate 1,100 megawatts each. So that gives you a sense of scale. But the physical size of the reactor depends sensitively on what kind of nuclear reactor it is. Different designs, some designs can be smaller and some could be larger, and there's no connection between that. The other term, modular, is supposed to evoke exactly the point that exactly the way you put it, as Lego blocks that come together. In this case, what they say is these are factory-built objects. So let me start with that. So modular construction is something we do all the time. Right? If you think about a neighboring apartment complex that is being built or an office building that's built, nobody brings bricks and wood and carpenters to the site to actually brick and make all the windows and the doors there. Everything is shipped to the place from factories, and all that is being done there is mostly assembly of these different components. It's exactly that process that is sought to be used in making small modular reactors. But that process was also used to make the AP1000 reactors that were constructed in Georgia. Westinghouse, at the turn of the century, when they were promoting not just the AP1000, but even the precursor to that, the AP600 design, which was in the 1990s, Westinghouse's attempt to come up with a new reactor design. They would say, because of this modular construction process that we have, and the design is modularly, is meant to be constructed in a modular fashion, we will be able to cut the time of construction. And it's going to be really fast. And for a long time now, it's no longer there on their website, but they used to have a little animated video which would show different parts of the reactor coming together. So it'll be month one, month two, month three, and it'll go on till 36 months. That used to be their time they would promise, and the thing would come together. On screen, it looks absolutely great. But unfortunately, what works on the screen doesn't work in the real world. So that's the modular. We have no reason to think that small modular reactors are going to be any different. They are also going to be delayed. They are also going to have problems that, if not happening in the site of construction, will happen in the factory, as happened in the case of AP1000s. But I want to come back to the small part, which I think is even more interesting. Around the world, countries that started to build nuclear power plants in the 1950s and 60s and so on, started by building small reactors. The first reactors that were built in the United States and Canada and India, all of them would fit the definition of small. They are all low-powered reactors. And then over a period of time, the nuclear industry started increasing the power levels. Why did they do that? Because they were trying to take advantage of what are called economies of scale. When you build a reactor that generates five times as much electricity, the company that owns it will sell five times as much electricity, will get five times as much revenue for it. But they don't have to spend five times as much money to build a reactor, because let's say a 1500 megawatt reactor does not need five times as much concrete as a 300 megawatt reactor. It doesn't need five times as many workers as a 300 megawatt reactor. So you save on cost when you go to larger sizes. And that's exactly why the nuclear industry started building bigger and bigger reactors. Despite all those economies of scale, nuclear power is the most expensive way to generate electricity today. And so this is the real conundrum that nobody wants to order nuclear plants because they are so expensive and you have to do all this political machination before you can get an order for a nuclear plant. So they come up with this new story saying, oh, we have these new designs, the so-called small modular reactors. Those are going to be somehow much faster, much cheaper, and so on and so forth. But if you look under the bonnet, as it were, there is no reason to expect that small modular reactors will solve any of the problems. There are, broadly speaking, four kinds of problems the nuclear industry itself sees for itself. In 2003, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology put out a report called The Future of Nuclear Power. This was kind of the height of the early stages of what's called the nuclear renaissance at that point. And they mentioned that there were four problems we have. The cost problem, the fact that there's a risk of accidents, that it produces nuclear waste, radioactive waste that we don't know how to deal with, and that there's a linkage with nuclear weapons proliferation. Now, of these four problems, three of the problems, the waste, the risk of accidents, and the linkage with nuclear weapons, are inherent to all nuclear reactors, whether they are small or large. Even a small modular reactor will produce enough plutonium to, let's say, make about 10 bombs every year. A small reactor, which is only generating, let's say, 200 megawatts. So that's really small in terms of how much electricity it supplies to a country, but it is quite a large amount of plutonium for use in nuclear weapons. So that's one of the challenges with this. And of course, all nuclear reactors have to produce radioactive waste, because that's an inherent part of the nuclear fission process, right, which is how you produce the heat. And I want to remind the listeners that a nuclear reactor ultimately is just a very complicated way to boil water using a hazardous process of nuclear fission. And so all of these attributes are related to that. And the reason why nuclear power plants are so expensive is because you're trying very hard to make sure that this radioactive material never exits into the biosphere, that there's no accident that allows this material to come out of the reactor and be spread out. But nevertheless, it's impossible to design a nuclear reactor with no possibility of an accident. The probability of an accident will always be greater than zero. And despite what the nuclear industry says, and I sort of explained this more in my book, there is no way to reliably calculate what the risk of an accident is, what the probability of an accident is. And all of these methods that they use have uncertainties. I've said a lot of things, but I just want to recap what I'm saying. All nuclear power plants have these three fundamental problems having to do with the physics of the reactor, the risk of accidents, the production of radioactive waste, and the linkage with nuclear weapons. And because of these things, the fourth problem that they face, the high cost of construction, is a result of all of these problems. Now, when you go to small reactors, how does the picture change? The most important element, I think, is thinking about the cost of it. Because of what I mentioned earlier about economies of scale, a small nuclear reactor will always be more expensive than a large nuclear reactor per unit of capacity, either power capacity or energy production. That's ultimately the most important metric. It's not the total cost. For the industry, it may be the total cost, because one of the lessons they learned from all of the rounds of nuclear reactors that were constructed in the post-nuclear renaissance era, whether it's Vogel, or whether it's Flamanville in France, or Olkiluoto in Finland, or the ongoing Hinkley Point project in the UK, is that the total absolute cost of these reactor projects is enormous. $35 billion, $40 billion. These are not amounts that most utilities actually have access to. So this is where the nuclear industry is coming in and saying, oh, you can build a small modular reactor because that will only cost you $3 billion or $5 billion. And that money you can probably find somewhere or the other. But the problem is that the $3 billion will fetch you far less electricity than the larger reactor project, right? So on a per unit basis, it's actually going to be more expensive.
That's a really thorough explanation of the economics behind. So let's get to the physical reality or lack thereof of these so-called small modular nuclear reactors. And that is, do any currently exist? Are any in operation? Are there prototypes? And are there any approved designs for building them?
Yes and no. There are two small modular reactor projects operating in Russia and in China. There are two floating power plants that Russia has operated since 2020, I think, for the last few years. Then there are two reactors, high temperature gas cooled reactors that China bought online a couple of years ago. What we can say about both of those projects is one, they also demonstrated all of the problems we've seen with nuclear projects. They were delayed. They were more expensive than they were initially costed at. And the second thing we have learned from them is that they are not operating very well. The Russian reactors, what we call the capacity factor, the efficiency with which the reactor is producing electricity, is around 30% in every year. Whereas the US nuclear reactors, when they are operating, for example, will operate around 90% capacity factor. So small modular reactors that are operating don't seem to be operating very well. The Chinese case is even more interesting in that within a year of the reactor being brought into commercial operation, the power output had to be reduced by 25%. It came down from 200 megawatt to 150 megawatt. We have no idea why, because China is not very transparent with all of its data. And secondly, that reactor, even at the lower power level in 2023, produced only enough power that it could have produced in 1 month of operation during the year. So it's almost as though for 11 months of the year, it was not operating. And then in the 12th month, suddenly it produced a certain amount of power. But of course, in reality, that's not how it would have probably operated. It was probably operating at a lower power level and going, you know, working and not working. And the integrated total amounts to 1 month of power output.
Other than China and Russia, speaking of the Western world, there's this big push by the US, by the UK, throughout the world to install small modular nuclear reactors. And I think that's what I'm looking for. Is there a standard design? Are there any prototypes? Do we know the technology will work? Does the technology exist anywhere except on some elaborate PowerPoints?
That's a great question. At one level, we can expect the technology to work in the sense that it's probably possible to build one of these nuclear reactors and have it produce electricity. But the question we should be asking is, will it be built on time? Will it be built on budget? Will it have a risk of accident? What are the risks of accidents associated? Those are the questions we should be asking. As I mentioned earlier, I think the examples of Russia and China are instructive in that they have tried to build these projects, and they demonstrate all of the problems we have seen with nuclear power plants, right? And so there's no reason to expect the United States power plants, SMRs, will be any different. And I'll also mention one other project, which is in the West, but not in the North. It's in Argentina. Argentina has been building a small modular reactor called CHARM since 2014. And at that time, they were predicting, when the construction started, that the reactor would be operating by late 2017 or early 2018.
Right? the clocks run differently in the nuke world.
Exactly, right? So it's now 2024, now they say 2028, but nobody really believes that's going to happen there. Coming to the United States, the only design that has been licensed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is this NuScale's 50 megawatt design. NuScale submitted that design, it was approved with some very important caveats. There were issues that had to be addressed, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, in my opinion, should not have given them the approval without ensuring that the issues they identified had been resolved by NuScale. But I think they were under political pressure to show that they can operate fast, and so they gave the approval. What is interesting is that between the time NuScale submitted that design for approval and the approval came, NuScale had changed its mind. It had increased the size of the output of the reactor from 50 megawatts to first to 60 megawatts and then to 77 megawatts. If you go to the NuScale website, you won't even see the 50 megawatt design advertised there anymore. Now, NuScale has gone back to NRC and said, okay, now we have a 7 megawatt design. Now you already approved our 50 megawatt design. Why don't you approve this one as well? And again, NRC has asked them a bunch of questions. In the meanwhile, NuScale's first sort of flagship project, the one that was proposed for UAMS, that project was canceled last November because the cost estimate had gone up to $9.3 billion. And that, I think, is very important because it's not just the fact that the cost was $9.3 billion, much higher than the $3, $4 billion they were initially talking about. But also, if you think about how much power you would have got for that $9.3 billion, it perfectly illustrates the lack of economies of scale that I mentioned earlier. So for $9.3 billion, this is the cost before the construction started, before any of the usual type of cost overruns happened, right? This is a cost estimate. $9.3 billion, 460 megawatts, means that the per megawatt or per kilowatt cost is more than the cost of Vogel. And this is all before all of the cost overruns. So actually the thing to compare with is actually the cost of Vogel when construction started. At that time, it was supposed to be $14 billion for around 2,200 megawatts. And if you do the math, you will find that this is about 250% of that cost estimate. So NuScale is already uneconomical without even the construction starting, right? So I don't think we really need many, many more experiments of this sort. But of course, you know, all of these countries, all of these very powerful institutions, including the Department of Energy in the US, and in Canada, we have our share of these nuclear promoters, are hope are five